We're very glad to be here with you all today. These sessions that we're going to have together, this evening we're going to be talking about marriage, and then tomorrow morning, two sessions, one on Jesus' teaching regarding divorce and remarriage, and Paul's teaching, and also some church history, is the second session. And then in the evening, how do we live in light of this teaching? What are some biblical examples of marriage situations? And Sunday morning, dealing with some of the difficult questions and situations that arise. And then Sunday afternoon, I'm going to deal with the issue of polygamy. So you can pray that God will enlighten all of our hearts as we go through this. You know, this topic that we're covering tonight is relevant to every society on the face of the earth. Because God instituted marriage at the dawn of creation. And God is the one who defines how it is to work. Now, in the pagan world, divorce and remarriage was widely practiced. But Christianity came along and taught something new. And that was that marriage is not dissolved by man. The lessening of Christian influence in recent centuries has resulted in a return to pagan ideas regarding marriage. And I believe that the perilous times in which we live endanger marriage. For example, you're familiar with the passage in 2 Timothy chapter 3. Know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. You know, those things that are mentioned there are things that are very dangerous to marriage. Lovers of their own selves. You see, self-denial then becomes unthinkable, and no wonder there are marriage conflicts. Covetousness. Things are more important than people. And people are accustomed these days to instant gratification. So, my wife doesn't satisfy, or my husband disappoints me, and therefore I'm unhappy. Disobedience to parents. Children grow up accustomed to having their own way. And another child grows up accustomed to having his own way. And they get married. Guess what? Big problems. Without natural affection. Isn't that characteristic of our times? People abort their own children, and they farm out their children to the babysitter and the school because they don't want to bother with them. Treacherous. Loving pleasures more than loving God. You know, we live in a society that is self-indulgent and indulges itself in a flood of sensuality. And then you see Romans chapter 1, vile affections. We live in a day that is set to destroy marriages. And see, this is a crisis for everyone. It's a crisis for the single because it's important to understand the permanence of marriage and what it means. And it's a crisis for the married to strengthen their own marriages. And it's a crisis for all the church because we need to give a proper testimony of God's design to the world and also to maintain the purity of the church. What results happen as a failure to adhere to God's standard? Not only is there a corruption of the failing couple, there's a corruption of the church in the present generation. And there's also a corruption of the understanding of what marriage is in future generations. I believe that many times people lack a biblical basis for dealing with a crisis. Part of this is because of ignorance. Many people are not taught how marriage really is supposed to be. But another reason is because of false doctrine being actively taught. You know, our society is in a fog regarding marriage because churches have taught false doctrine on this area. In fact, it's a sad commentary that the divorce remarriage rate in evangelical churches is higher than in the society at large. Now we need to understand how the Bible is written. The Bible is easy for an unsophisticated person to understand if he really loves the truth. But if you are hoping for an answer that will satisfy the flesh, the Bible is written in a way, deliberately, I believe, that you will stumble over the very thing you're looking for, and you'll find it. You'll find the very thing to stumble over that you're hoping to find. You know, Jesus said, when he was asked, "Why do you speak in parables?" He spoke in parables so that those who gathered around him and really wanted to know could find out, and so that those who didn't want to know wouldn't understand. And there are many people, if you have your mind set on taking your own way, there are many people who will help you twist the scriptures to your own destruction. So what is the solution to this? I believe the solution is to study God's word before a crisis erupts. Quite a few years ago, I began doing a series of messages in churches on how to have a godly family. And as time went on, I began to see I should have a session on the subject of divorce and remarriage. And so, sometimes I would do that. And I began to see that there are many places where this subject is not really taught. And then people move into a crisis. And once they're in a crisis regarding marriage, often they're so emotionally involved that it's difficult for them to hear the truth on this subject. If you wait until someone is in a crisis regarding marriage, you've waited too long. We need to understand that wrong conclusions on this matter have terrible consequences. Because if we do not declare fully what God has said, and we say less than He says, and allow for more variations in marriage than what He allows, that will make people feel comfortable walking straight to hell. On the other hand, if we are more strict than what God is, then we will cause people to commit sin and have serious spiritual consequences. Remember that all of us will be judged by God's word, not by our opinions and not by anyone else's opinions. And so, how can we come to proper conclusions? We must begin not with man's experience, not with man's insights. You see, if you base your study on marriage regarding the experience of certain people or the insights of certain people, that will lead you astray. I believe the reason this subject is so murky is not because God's word is not clear, but it's because the church has departed from the word of God. You see, the wisdom of men is foolishness with God. And so we need to begin with the scriptures, which is God's wisdom. And that means not imposing our opinions about what people should do, but showing what is God's opinion regarding marriage. And in doing that, we need to understand the connection between mercy and truth. If we have truth without mercy, it will lead to an attitude of condemnation. And if we have mercy without truth, it will lead to license. But mercy and truth leads to righteousness. So how do we approach the scriptures on this subject? First of all, the clear texts must define the basic framework. And then difficult passages must fit into that framework. And then there are some passages that are neutral in themselves. You know, many times there's so many worthless debates that go on. Because here's a verse that could be interpreted this way by itself, or it could be interpreted the opposite way by itself. And so people have big fights over those verses without dealing with the whole picture. Now, if you deal with the whole picture and realize this verse The whole picture tells us this verse must be this way. Then you have the answer. And so, much very plausible sounding discussion often is worthless. Now, there are two fundamental questions we need to ask regarding marriage. These questions are so important and so fundamental that if you answer these two questions correctly, it will provide the answers to practically all the rest of your questions. Number one, what constitutes marriage? Number two, what dissolves a marriage? Those two questions, answered correctly and biblically, will provide the answers to practically every question you can ask regarding marriage. Now I invite you to critical thinking this weekend. Let me say that there is a false notion afloat called corporate consensus of truth. You know, many groups have agreed together to embrace lies. Just corporate consensus is not enough. We meet together so that we can help one another come to a better understanding of what God says. We meet together realizing that we individually don't have all the insight and don't have all the gifts and don't have all the answers. But it's not that we corporately agree together that this is right or that is right. We corporately come together so that we may understand truth better. And so we must agree together to embrace the truth, regardless of where that truth may lead and regardless of what the cost may be. And so the goal is knock down everything false and embrace everything true. So I invite you to take notes on things that come to your mind. And then we will plan to have some open discussions at the end of the sessions. And so I invite you to refute every statement I make, if you can, from the Scriptures. It's not enough just to disagree. You must show us from the Scriptures what the truth is. You see, it's not just that I am come here to make a presentation, but we come together so that as an end result, all of us can be wiser than when we came. So that all of us can be more committed to upholding God's standard. God's standard in the midst of a society that doesn't like what God says. God's standard in the midst of churches who don't like what God says. And God's standard even in the midst of church leaders who don't like what God says. So what we're going to do is have this discussion, presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions over the preceding session. Not just questions in general, but questions over what we've covered so far. This evening we're going to be looking at a biblical understanding of marriage. Marriage is a creation ordinance. I believe understanding that is critical for understanding this topic. And both Jesus and the Apostle Paul, when they discussed the issue of marriage, brought their listeners back to the creation events. When the Pharisees questioned Jesus regarding divorce in Matthew 19, Jesus took them to marriage as instituted at creation. Haven't you read? God made them male and female. What God has joined, let not man separate. And then they thought, well, that doesn't account for Moses' situation and him allowing for divorce. And Jesus replied, from the beginning, it was not so. And he concludes with a strict view that remarriage after divorce was adultery. And also the Apostle Paul, when he dealt with relationships and roles of men and women, he goes back to creation, Ephesians 5, the husband-wife relationship, and woman's subjection, founded in Adam being first formed, then Eve, 2 Timothy 2:13. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 9, woman was created for the man. And so, to understand marriage, we have to go back to the beginning. Any question that you're asked regarding divorce must focus, first of all, in the answer, on marriage, lest we fall into the same trap the Pharisees fell into, and in fact, many contemporaries fall into as well, because they focus not on marriage, but they focus on divorce. So what are the principles that we should learn from Genesis 1 and 2 regarding marriage? First of all, marriage is a divine institution, not a human one. It is a divine institution for humans. The scope is that it's a creation ordinance. It's for all times and all people. This is not a church ordinance. Marriage is given in the sphere of creation, not in the sphere of redemption. Now, this does not deny, of course, that marriage does have symbolic implications regarding Christ and the church. But the point is, marriage is not given to Christians alone. It is given to all of humanity. That's very important because sometimes people debate about whether their marriage was valid or not because whether it happened before they became a Christian or not. That has nothing to do with it at all. Now, if we view marriage instead of being a divine institution as being a human institution, that will corrupt marriage. Why? Because man thinks that he devised marriage for the protection of his property and so his family would not be disturbed. That, in fact, is false. Adam didn't even know he needed marriage until God showed him so. And if marriage, after all, is devised by men, then men can change it to suit their fancies. He can have divorce, polygamy, mistresses, concubines, or he can completely abolish marriage whatsoever. In fact, one of the things that's happening these days, they're talking about group marriage, where three or four men and three or four women just decide to all get married as a group. You see what's happening there? They are not taking into account that God is the one who defined this thing. And as soon as you think that man defines it, then it's open for all kinds of corruptions and aberrations. Remember, because it's a divine institution, Hebrews 13, verse 4, marriage is honorable in all and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. It's a divine institution, and it's the doctrine of devils to forbid it, 1 Timothy 4, 1-3. Marriage is not a human institution. It is a divine institution for humans, and that is a vast difference. The second thing we notice regarding marriage from Genesis 1 and 2 is that man needs marriage. Man was created incomplete, deliberately, by God. In the midst of a perfect creation, which God repeatedly affirmed was good, it was good, it was good, all of a sudden, God said, it is not good for man to be alone. And God said, I will make a helper comparable to him. Genesis 2:18. I will make him a helper comparable to him. The idea here is a helper that's a co-equal and complementary. And notice the very next verse, verse 19. When God decided, I'm going to make a helper for the man, then he gave Adam an animal naming assignment. That was the first step. Why did he do that? He gave him that assignment to make him aware of his need. Oh, there's a male and female giraffe. And there is a male and female elephant. And there is all these pairs. And so, where is my counterpart? Did you notice Adam didn't say, hey, those chimpanzees look pretty good. Nothing of the kind. What does it say? It says, whatever Adam called each living creature, that was its name. So Adam gave names to all cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. That tells you that in all of the animal, bird, fish creation, there is nothing that is comparable to man. Nothing. And so, Adam says, I don't see anything out there. God said, thank you very much. That's the first lesson you're supposed to get. Then, verse 21, the Lord caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. And you know the story there. You see, this shows that woman is not an inferior being. And Adam is going to cherish something he needed rather than regarding her as merely a dispensable piece of property. Now, this incompleteness means that in general it's best for men and women to marry. In the New Testament, you have specific admonition regarding this. 1 Timothy 5:14, Paul directs the younger widows to marry. And there also are exceptions regarding marriage. 1 Corinthians 7:39, marry only in the Lord, believers are told. And Matthew 19, verse 12, some are to be eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And the unmarried have special opportunities for special service to God, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 32 to 35. But man needing marriage, he experiences completion through the woman. You see, the husband is to live his life through his wife in planning and thinking and working. His efforts are enhanced by her input and her help and her refinements, consulting with her and fellowshipping with her. During the first 2 years of our marriage, I was in graduate school working on a PhD in mathematics. And you know, sometimes if you're working on mathematics at that level, you encounter problems that are very hard. I know sometimes people think that algebra is hard, but the kind of problems I'm talking about are a lot harder. And sometimes I would think about these problems and I would be stumped by this thing that I'm supposed to solve. So what I would do is I would explain the problem to Rhoda. Now, to explain this complex mathematical problem to her, I had to go into various detail about what it meant and what kind of things I was dealing with and what kind of aspects these things had, and now this thing implied this, and now I've got this problem and you're supposed to prove this, and I don't know how to get there. And you know, as I did that, can you imagine what happened? I got the answer. Because in explaining it to her, so that she could get a concept of what was going on, I had to organize all this in my mind and show the sequential flow, and then the answer would come. Now, what if she would have just said, I'll never understand that stuff. That isn't of any interest to me. That whole avenue of interaction would have been missed. And I'd have been stuck without knowing the answer to the problem. You know, I believe that the husband and the wife should really be interacting together. Decisions regarding children or the business or the husband's recreation or working on some project around the house. Does the husband welcome his wife's input on how to modify his own ideas to make them better? I mean, after all, isn't that a privilege? You have an idea and you can talk to your wife and she can tell you, you know what? If you do this, it would get even better. There are a lot of husbands that are too proud to listen to such advice. We built a house some years ago as a family project. And in this house, there was a thing called a cold air return that you have for the heating system. Well, what should we put above that? And Rhoda had a great idea that we could put the stereo equipment in there. So we can have it up there. It's out of the range of little toddlers that happen to come to your house sometimes and don't know when to keep fingers off. It all works very nice. You see, just as a wife, biblically, may not live unsubmissively to her husband, the husband must not live independently from his wife, as if she weren't really necessary. You know, any husband who is not benefiting from his wife's input is really foolish. Another thing we learn from Genesis 1 and 2 is that marriage defines the functional relationship between husband and wife. Man is to be the leader and the wife is to submit as helper being created for him. 1 Corinthians 11 verse 9, the woman was created for the man and the focus of her ministry is being a helper for that man. You see, the husband and wife are not free, under God's standards, to choose what kind of functional relationship they will have, because God has defined this thing. God has already specified how it will be. God deliberately created the man first and created the woman to be his helper. Another thing we learn is that the marriage partner, that is the woman, is truly glorified. glorious. Humanity is spoken of as being created male and female, both in the image of God, chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. But notice that God took special care how he created the woman. God made Adam out of dirt, but God, when he made woman, started at a much higher level. He started with a piece of living bone and flesh. Now that is a lot higher. You see, he specially built Eve from Adam himself. And that emphasizes the glorious oneness of the man and his wife. And it shows the folly of the husband who tramples on his wife. You know, if he tramples on his wife, he's trampling on himself. And he's trampling on God, who gave her to him as the crowning act of creation. And this woman is specifically, in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, is described as the glory of the man. So you ladies, sometimes if you feel discouraged, just remember, God made man out of dirt. But woman, he started at a higher place. And this is a lesson that is desperately needed. You know, pagan cultures degrade women. In fact, John Patton, who was a missionary in the 1800s to the South Sea cannibals, he preached against wife beating. And some of those old chiefs didn't know how this would work. If we don't beat our wives, how will we get them to obey us? Because after all, if you beat a few and kill a few and eat a few, the rest are very submissive for a long time. Well, the gospel has a different idea, doesn't it? You know, sometimes, even in churches, men almost view their wives as a slave and disdain her as only needing to submit. You know, I believe that such husbands don't understand the first thing about what marriage really can be. We also learn from Genesis 1 and 2 that marriage is the monogamous union of one man and one woman. There is a grammatical singularity here. It is Adam, singular. Eve, singular. A man, his wife. There's only one male and only one female. Marriage is the union for one man and one woman. Incidentally, there is no such thing as homosexual marriage. That is a modern confusion of terms. And you notice also in Genesis 1 and 2 that the person must be eligible for marriage. He leaves father and mother. He is not leaving some other marriage relationship. And he is not already married and adding another one. That's a contrast, of course, to the arrogant Lamech in chapter 4, generations later, who took two wives. Furthermore, in Genesis 1 and 2, we find out that marriage is intimate. You leave father and mother. And you can ask this question, why would anyone do this? God makes the comment, therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. We know it's God making that comment rather than Adam, because of Jesus' statement in Matthew 19, verses 4 and 5, attributing those words to the Creator. It's based on Adam's comment, this is my bones and my flesh. What this means is, this is the only person in the whole world who truly and exclusively belongs to me. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And so, a person leaves father and mother, the most intimate of relationship, for one that's even better. You have exclusive companionship, and you have a continuity of fellowship. It extends beyond the lifetime of the parent. This marriage relationship has precedence over parent-child relationships. It's a new relationship. It's separate from parents. You know, physically, a wife is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. It's not necessarily geographical, because Abraham lived with Isaac and Jacob. Hebrews 11, verse 9 tells us so. Emotionally, there is a mutual comfort that is better than parent to child. Do you remember Rebekah and Isaac? It says, Isaac loved Rebekah and he was comforted concerning his mother's death, and she had died 3 years earlier. Spiritually, there's a new relationship, a mystical oneness created by God. And then financially as well, a new relationship. You don't expect to live on your parents' living standard. And you're not expecting your parents to bail you out of some kind of financial difficulty. There's a loyalty shift. It forsakes this loyalty, supreme loyalty to parents. That's the closest earthly tie. To the join the new spouse in a new supreme loyalty. And it's a new loyalty for both. The man leaves father and mother. No apron strings here. And the woman becomes a helper for her husband, not an extension of her own parents' desires. Imagine the hopeless conflict. If you have two sets of parents who disagree, and both are insisting on their ideas for the new family. You have a new autonomous household. And this is illustrated by the patriarchs. The focus of the Old Testament accounts there in Genesis shifts to the new generation at marriage, even though the parent is still living. Isaac eclipses Abraham, and then Jacob eclipses Isaac, and then Jacob's sons control his relationship to Egypt. This new autonomous household is also illustrated by Numbers chapter 30 on the law regarding vows. A vow of a young woman at home was subject to cancellation by her father. That's verses 3 to 5. If a woman with a vow upon her gets married, the new husband can cancel the vow that her father let stand. That's verses 6 to 8. Now that distinction is obscured in the King James, but it's clearer in the New King James or the New American Standard or the NIV. The implication is that God approves of the primacy of the new home, not a continuation of the old patriarch authority in that new home. And also you have, in terms of this intimacy, cling to the wife. Not only leave father and mother, but cling to the wife. The Hebrew word there is dabak. And if you want to know what a word means, Hebrew or Greek, don't just go to Strong's. Instead, get a concordance and see how that word is used in the various contexts that it appears in Scripture. So in this case, the Hebrew word dabak, here are some of the ways it's used. It's used regarding physical joining or proximity. For example, 2 Samuel 23:10, his hand clave to the sword, or of overtaking someone. Laban overtook Jacob in pursuit. That was Genesis 31, verse 23. Or of a disease clinging to a person. Leprosy, for example, clinging to Gehazi, 2 Kings 5:27. It's also used to describe loyalty, clinging to the Lord in obedience to Him, Deuteronomy 4, 4, Deuteronomy 10, verse 20, Chapter 11, verse 22, chapter 13, verse 4, chapter 30, verse 20, Joshua 22, verse 5, and chapter 23, verse 8. A covenant loyalty. Proverbs 18, 24, a friend that clings closer than a brother. And a clinging to sin. 2 Kings 3, 3, Jehoram, son of Ahab, clinging to the sins of Jeroboam. It's also used to refer to the relationship of a man and woman. Clinging to your wife, Genesis 2:24, and Shechem's passionate attraction to Dinah in Genesis 34:3. Now, some people say that this word means passionate attraction and permanence, but the idea of a passionate attraction is certainly context driven. The basic idea is cling, and it's applied in various ways according to the context. You know, if you're clinging to the sword, or if a disease is clinging to a person, whatever. The meaning is hold on to, don't let go. And it's often a grasping, active thing that is determined to keep it. So you have the idea of permanence in there, within the scope of its context. And so, the predominant usages in the Old Testament are either physical closeness or loyalty. Therefore, when you think about these meanings, it shows what an appropriate word it is. A man shall cleave to his wife. So in marriage, you have an active determination to keep his wife. It's not passive. There's a physical closeness. There's a covenant loyalty. And there's permanence. And then it says, they shall be one flesh. You know, that's the terminology in Hebrew, they shall be one flesh. But the New Testament is even stronger. It says, the two shall become one flesh, Ephesians 5:31. And Matthew 19, verse 6, they are no more two, but one flesh. Now, this one flesh is more than sexual union. Animals are male and female, but they are never described in the Scripture as one flesh. And spouses are one flesh, even when not sexually united. It's a union of persons. There's a great mystery involved here. God performs a miracle. He performed a literal miracle with Adam and Eve, literally making Adam and Eve one flesh. And God miraculously joins a man and woman in marriage today. Man is not joining himself. Jesus said, what God has joined. It's an act performed by God, and so God is the one that dissolves this bond. Now, the contrast is a man joins himself to a harlot, 1 Corinthians 6:15 and 16. The emphasis is not so much becoming one flesh as a process. You see, leaving father and mother and cleaving to your wife is something that this couple actually does. But becoming one flesh is something that happens to them when they marry, something that God does. Incidentally, that fits with the parallel construction you have in Genesis 2:7, man became a living soul, and Genesis 2:24, what God has joined. So there's an amazing new relationship of which no flesh and blood connection existed before. The terminology, my flesh and our flesh, is used to describe near kinship. You can see that in Genesis 29 verses 12 to 14 and 37 verse 27 and Judges 9, 2 and 2 Samuel 19:13. One flesh is stronger and implies that the new relationship is closer than the relationship that the child had with his parents. This is illustrated by the experience of Job. You remember, Satan had permission to strike everything Job had. And so what did he do? He struck Job's possessions, and he struck his children. And then Satan had a discussion with God, and he got permission to strike Job's flesh. What happened then? He struck Job's health, and he struck Job's wife. You see, the wife was not counted as a possession. She was counted as Job's flesh. I think that is very significant. The intimacy of this relationship is emphasized by experience. You know, those who lose a spouse experience a great loss. And the misery of those who forsake a spouse and are joined to another, those who disregard God's laws, whether it's in marriage or whether it's in physics, embrace misery and ruin. And then the end of the chapter says that they were unashamed in their nakedness. You know, a person who is living righteously is not ashamed of his own physical being. And God's standard for marriage is for spouses to be unashamed before their spouse regarding of anything in their life. Another thing we should learn about marriage from Genesis 1 and 2 is that marriage is a cherished gift from God. Adam said, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. Ephesians 5:29, every man cherishes his own flesh. And marriage is a very special treasure. It's wonderful. Also, we learn from Genesis that marriage is permanent. It's the language of permanence, the Hebrew word dabak. One flesh, no more two. Now, what separates a man from his own flesh? Only death. A man can't say, well, today I think I'll just be separated from my flesh. He dies and he can be separated from his flesh. And so, therefore, nothing but death separates a man from his wife. It's impossible for a man to leave himself. And this fits precisely with the Apostle Paul's statement in Ephesians 5, "He who loves his wife loves himself." In verse 28, the first part of the verse says, he ought to love his wife as himself. But in the last part of verse 28, it says, a man who loves his wife loves himself. It's a statement of fact. It's a statement of rationale for why he ought to love his wife. You see, it's not a command to love his wife, but it's a statement of fact that since they're no longer two, but they're one, then a man who loves his wife is loving himself. Furthermore, from Genesis, the marriage is intended to be fruitful. God's command is multiply. Now, what does this mean? It does not mean just having two children, one boy and one girl. That isn't multiplying. That's just staying even. It does not mean just deliberately saying, well, we have three. That's all we want. Because that would just be merely adding. That'd be staying even and adding one. Multiplication means multiplying. You know? And before God, whether you multiply by two, three, four, or five, you and him. We'll have to see about that. Now, what is the theological definition of marriage? You see, there are three definitive elements from Genesis 2:24. Leave father and mother, cling to your wife, one flesh. And so what are the requirements for marriage? Number one, you must be eligible for marriage. Leaving father and mother, not leaving some other marriage relationship. And that fits with statements that you hear at weddings sometimes. Sometimes you'll hear this statement. Speaking to one of the people getting married, are you free from all other marriage relationships whatsoever? You see, it's a question of, are you eligible for marriage? It's a good statement. Or, who gives this woman in marriage? And it's the father. You see, if the father has already given her away at an earlier occasion to an earlier marriage, he can't give her away again. It's not his to give. A second requirement for marriage is consent of the partners. Somebody might say, well, what about Jacob and Leah? After all, Jacob was tricked, and probably Leah was pressured by her father. But you know something? Jacob should have checked who he was marrying. He agreed without seeing. And Leah, by her own choice, was party to the deception. There would have been dozens of ways that she could have let Jacob know that she wasn't his beloved Rachel. And thus, they were both responsible for the decisions they made, and the marriage stood. Incidentally, among Christians in Nigeria, there is a wedding tradition that the groom lifts the veil as a double check to see who is there. I was talking to a lawyer one time, and he said, there is no such thing as an unintentional contract. A third aspect of marriage is a covenant of commitment. This notion of a covenant of commitment is emphasized by God when he speaks to apostates in Malachi 2:13 and following, especially verse 14. It's also spoken of regarding the immoral woman in Proverbs 2:17, where it speaks of her as the one who violated the covenant of her marriage. And in the Old Testament, the idea of covenant is repeatedly used regarding God's relationship to Israel, whom he regarded as his wife. It shows the importance of covenant in definition of marriage. It is a serious matter to break this covenant, Ezekiel 16:8 and 59. And in these examples, there's no idea or no hint that the covenant is just a temporary arrangement, but it's something that is permanent and it was violated. A fourth requirement in relation to marriage is a public declaration of a marriage event. This is an essential element. It defines when the marriage begins. When a man leaves father and mother, that's a public act. And you know, society recognizes that the status of the couple changes from being unmarried to married. Now, the form of this declaration may vary from society to society. Remember, marriage is an institution for humans in a human society. For example, I know a missionary who has served in the country of Ghana in Africa, and there, part of the bride price goes to the bride's brothers. And they're supposed to take this money and use it to proclaim in the town that their sister is already spoken for. Now, often there's no formal ceremony, and two families agree, and the bride price is paid, and they live together, and the covenant is understood. But you see how there's a public announcement regarding this couple. These are the ones. In Nigeria, there is a tribal group there, nomadic cattle herders, called Fulani. And there they believe it is highly indecent for a couple to attend their own wedding. So a big marriage feast occurs, the wedding ceremony is there, the couple is absent, and people stand in by proxy. Are you willing to teach this woman the principles of the Muslim way? And these questions are answered, and there's a big feast, and the bride and groom are not there, their parents are not there, their close friends are not there. But people know that this is the procedure for bringing these two persons from being unmarried to married. Even if you have a wedding or a marriage that was performed by the magistrate at the courthouse, there are witnesses there. Before I left home, I called up the clerk at the courthouse and I asked what kind of requirements, if somebody wants to get married by the magistrate, what are the requirements? And one of the requirements is you must have two witnesses who must be 18 or older. I said, well, what if a couple comes and they don't have any? Would a couple secretaries in the office do? She said, yes, that'd be fine. But do you see what's going on there? There is a public event, a public declaration that these people are moving from unmarried to married. And we have biblical precedent for this. Some people begin to waffle here. They say, well, Isaac, all he did, he took Rebekah into his tent. Now, wait a minute. Was Isaac's marriage a public event? Start thinking. The servant left Abraham's household with how many camels? Anybody know? 10. 10 camels. Here's a caravan of 10 camels that are going to a far country to get a bride for Isaac. Is that a public event? So he goes to this far country. He meets this woman, talks to her brother and her father and her mother, and have this big discussion, and they agree to send her back to marry this man in this other country the next day. And so they go back. Is that a public event? What's the answer? Yes, it's very public. And then, of course, when they go back and they meet Isaac meditating in the field, and you have these 10 camels, you think one man is guiding all those camels? Of course not. There's some other men there too. There was a big public. You think Abraham was there? I think so. It was a big public event, wasn't there? Boaz took careful public legal steps regarding marriage to Ruth. You know, there was a private conversation between him and Ruth. You can read about it in Ruth 3, verse 12 and 13. But then there's a public event, taking her as his wife, chapter 4, verses 10 to 12, with emphasis on witnesses, verse 11. The marriage at Cana. Jesus and his disciples attended. That's a public event. John 2, verses 1 and 2. Well, what about Adam and Eve, somebody's going to say? You know something? The whole world was there. But besides, God physically brought her to the man. Now let me ask you this. Who was Eve's father? God. And God had put Adam to sleep and made Eve. And then God, the Father, brought Eve to the man. Is that a public event? Yes, it is. You see, it wasn't that Adam just happened to meet Eve in the garden and said, "Whoo, I believe we're made for each other." There's a publicity of covenants. Genesis 31, verses 43 to 55, the stone of witness where Laban and Jacob were meeting. It was public for future times. What about this? What about a public covenant where both never intended as marriage but as a legal deception for entry into the country? That kind of thing happens. What's the answer? The answer is simple. If somebody got false papers saying they were married, then they're not married. But if a couple went through the marriage event, even though they're doing it just to sneak somebody into the country, you know what? They're married. Now, let me give some examples of unions not publicly declared. I was talking to a man one time, and he told me about how a woman and her boyfriend had promised together before God to be man and wife. And then later they separated. And then later this woman got married. And the man I was talking to was the one who married her. And after his marriage, he found out that this had happened. And then he wondered with tears, was she married back there? You know what the answer is? No, she wasn't. It was not a publicly declared covenant. Someone raised this question about some of these kind of issues. Well, what about the other man in that story? Was it really a commitment on his part? Or was it sort of going along with something she wanted? Or did they live together as man and wife? Or did they publicly present themselves as man and wife? When they went to a hotel, did they sign up as man and wife? Did they open a joint bank account? Wouldn't those things be evidence of marriage? And the answer is, none of those things prove marriage at all. Because people have joint bank accounts even if they aren't married. And people check into hotels pretending to be married when they aren't married. And people actually live as husband and wife for years without being married. This whole thing of going out into the woods and promising before God that we're husband and wife, that is not marriage. I have a friend who knows a couple that got married by proxy while separated by the Atlantic. There were witnesses on both sides, and that marriage was consummated after the war. You know, that is marriage. Well, what about common law? Is that marriage? Sometimes people say, well, the state, after a man and woman live together for enough years, that's discounted as common law marriage. You know what the problem is? There's no covenant, no public declaration. It's only a de facto recognition by default. And here's a decisive reason it's not marriage. If common law made it marriage, then it would have this implication. Live in sin long enough and it will cease to be sin. That is impossible. In fact, it's interesting if you have discussions with people who are living in common law type situations, they do not view it as marriage themselves. I have a friend who said his sister lived with a man for over 20 years. And then finally they got married. And during those years he had relationships with other women. He also knew of a couple with a long-term relationship and several children. But the man specifically said, I don't want to get married. In other words, he viewed marriage as something different from what he was doing. Now we also need to clarify something. Clearly, the issue here is an appropriate witness in the context of the society. It is not whether a certain clergyman said a certain word or the details of the exact procedure, but it's witnesses where there's a public event that society of that situation recognizes moves this couple from being unmarried to married. That's what marriage is. Now, the contrast is modern Western engagement. What is engagement? Engagement is a personal promise, even if some public announcements are made. It's a personal promise of intention to marry. But it's not considered legally binding. It's a promise to get married at some future event. It is not marriage. You know, when people say, well, I promised I would marry him, everybody knows they aren't married yet. That promise does not marry you. You're just saying, I agree to getting married to you later. And therefore, a broken engagement, regardless of the reason, has no bearing on whether any subsequent marriage is valid. What is the significance of physical union? Often when people start discussing the issue of what defines marriage, they will say that the necessary component is physical union. Now, 1 Corinthians 7 makes it clear that physical union is a responsibility within the covenant relationship, but I believe it is not part of the marriage definition. Eve was Adam's wife before that marriage was consummated. You know, when he saw her, he said, "This is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh." Mary was Joseph's wife. Consummation waited for months. You can read about it in Matthew chapter 2, verses 18, 24, and 25. And furthermore, simply because of physical circumstances, many couples are unable to consummate their marriage immediately. Also, I should mention that the activities that necessarily precede consummation would be totally inappropriate for those not yet married. So I believe that consummation and one flesh, physical union, is part of the marriage relationship, but it does not define whether or not you've been married. Now, the reason that has to be addressed, because sometimes there are marriages that weren't consummated, and then a person wants to say, "Well, I really wasn't married anyway." Furthermore, physical union does not produce marriage. Now, it's just amazing how often you have to answer questions and objections, because people come up with the strangest things. I've had a man come to me and talk about how he believed that if someone consorted with a harlot, then that meant he was married to that person. And so then later on, when he got married to someone else, he was living in adultery because that sexual union with that harlot made him married to that woman. You know what? That is foolishness. The Scripture always portrays sex outside of marriage as sin. Sin does not produce marriage. Hebrews 13, verse 4, "Marriage is honorable in all and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge." And at the top of the lists, Galatians 5, verse 19, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 9 and 10, you have these sexual sins. If you read the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 22, verses 23 to 30, various cases are enumerated where there was sexual sin. Some required death, and others required marriage or a fine or impossibility of divorce. But obviously, when you read those passages, promiscuous behavior did not create marriage. It said if you had a relationship with a virgin, then you had to marry her. Obviously, you weren't married yet. The fornicator had to marry her unless the father utterly refused, and he had to pay the bride price regardless. Exodus 22, verses 16 and 17. What is the clear implication of this? The implication is, if a man does to a virgin what is reserved by God for only a husband, he is obligated to publicly become her husband and perform the rest of the duties as a husband. But sexual union does not make him her husband. This whole notion of a casual union with a harlot, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 16. Sometimes people say, "Well, it says there, God makes them one flesh." You know, that union with a harlot involves two things. It involves both a sinful act and a sinful bond. You see, marriage is not the only place where one flesh occurs. There are two kinds of one flesh: physical union and miracle union, which God creates. Now, union with a harlot is an evil physical union, but it is not a miracle God union. In fact, if you read 1 Corinthians chapter 6, you will notice conspicuously absent is God joined statement. The one flesh is emphasized. You see, God made man and woman, male and female, to accommodate the God joins union. But Satan perverts this provision, and there is polluting oneness, joining to a harlot, joining to a divorced person. And the contrast is found in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 14. Remaining with a legitimate but unbelieving spouse actually sanctifies the unbeliever. And then both types of union are seen in Hebrews 13, verse 4. Furthermore, notice that union with a harlot is not equated with marriage. In that very passage, 1 Corinthians 6, verse 16, instead it's described as being sin against one's own body. How is it that this sin is against one's own body? I believe that one of the aspects of this is the very act of joining his flesh into a forbidden relationship places a man in this kind of position. A man naturally loves his own flesh. And now he's enlarged the scope of his body to include one for whom it's evil to love in this sense. And this creates a great tension in himself, igniting ferocious passions seeking the forbidden. What about a live-in union? That doesn't make marriage. The woman at Samaria had five husbands and was living with one not her husband. And we don't know how long this last pair was living together. But clearly, Jesus did not regard this cohabitation as making marriage. Even an officially sanctioned union that you have in the Old Testament, where there's a distinction between concubines and wives, living with a woman as a concubine did not put her into the same class as what's described as a wife. So what summary would we have of requirements? One, for marriage, the person must be eligible for marriage, not leaving some other marriage, not adding to another marriage. There needs to be consent of partners. There needs to be covenant of commitment. There needs to be a public declaration. Now also, when we understand marriage, we see in the New Testament, Ephesians chapter 5, that marriage is a picture of Christ and the church. And if you glance at Ephesians 5, you'll see at the beginning of the chapter, in verses 3 to 12, the ugly perversion of marriage, and then in verses 22 to 32, the glorious union of proper marriage. And this relationship between the church and Christ is so wonderful that the two become one. Christ is the head, and we're the body. Now notice, Adam's relationship to Eve. Adam's flesh to form Eve. In Genesis 2:24, the intimacy is based on the fact of her being part of his body. And Christ's deep sleep of death. His side was pierced. The church was formed. And then, of course, in Galatians 2:20, Christ lives in me. So this union occurs when we're baptized into Christ by the Spirit. Now, what are the implications of this? We need to refuse the worldly perversions of relationship and covenant. You know, the bride of Christ will never be divorced by Christ. And of course, remember, the bride is not individual, but corporate. And the church at the moment is the betrothed bride and will not be actually married until the marriage supper of the Lamb described in Revelation 19. Human divorce mars this symbol. And when we understand Ephesians chapter 5, we see how that marriage is elevated through this Christ-church metaphor. And any understanding of marriage that misses out on this is too low in its expectations. Because the husband is to love his wife like Christ loves the church. And the wife is to obey her husband like the true church obeys Christ. Now, what does that mean? Again, you have things slithering around that bring confusion. Sometimes people say, well, if a husband gives a command, even if it's an evil, wicked command, the wife should obey it, and then God will deal with him, and she'll go free. You know what? That is not true. Because if there's a conflict and a contradiction, any authority says, do this, and it contradicts what God says, we have to say we will obey God rather than men. And you see, after all, the husband must be in line with the headship order. The head of every man is Christ, whether he's a believer or not. And the head of Christ is God, and the head of woman is man. So what if some husband commands his wife to do a wicked thing? On that very issue, he has stepped out of that headship order, and he has no authority whatsoever on that point. None. He may have authority in other areas, but he has no authority to contradict God. We've got to get that straight. And so, in marriage, what should we be doing? We should illustrate the high standard of Christ in the church. You know, that means when you sin in marriage, when you're unkind, unthoughtful, unfair, whatever it might be, you face that sinfulness and you ask forgiveness and you're cleansed. And you daily press forward to this high goal that you have pictured in Ephesians chapter 5. I believe that we should avoid the blasphemy of mediocre marriage. You know, sometimes people think, well, if we're just sticking together, that's fine. No, that's not enough. This is to be a picture of the glorious relationship of Christ and the church. And so we need to magnify the glorious relationship of Christ and the church by having a glorious marriage.